When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is episode 306. I'm joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. I almost slipped there.
I almost thought I was promoted for a brief second, but...
Can't be promoted. Really. Nope.
Yeah.
Nope. If anything, you're getting demoted, you know, as we're just aging.
Stop the steal. I mean...
Stop the steal. Jesus, got to edit all of this out. Anyway, this is a special podcast. This is a Quack Watch Threads edition podcast. If you're not on Threads, don't do it. You guys need another social media app, like you need another hole in your head. But if you're curious, I am on this app, and I do occasionally respond to misinformation that I see, generally in a polite way, which you guys will hopefully be able to see, because I just copy-pasted my exact responses, and we're going to talk about them. We're going to expand on some of the stuff that I found on Threads that I think qualifies as like maybe like a Temu version of Quack Watch. You know?
Sure.
But I also anonymized all these people because I don't want to platform them. So the first one I came up with, this individual posted on Threads, and I quote, "Medications treat symptoms, not diseases. You need to heal the root of the problem to see real results. Share if you agree." Just a pithy little kind of thing, meaningless. And my reply was, biologics, anti-neoplastics, those are medications that treat certain forms of cancer, antibiotics, anti-obesity medications, and many more would beg to differ. The idea that these things actually do address the root cause, not just the symptoms. So it's just like, yeah, on its face, this is false. And also, I kind of wonder what they think the root cause actually is. Like, if taken to its logical end, like, what is the root cause of all of these different types of disease? Like, do you go to genetics, environment, luck, circumstance? Like, you know, if that's where you're going. Yeah. Like, if that's where you're going with this, it's like, yeah, we need to change our environment and, like, you know, better match it to our existing genetics and give everybody the same sort of opportunity. Like, are you sure that's what you're saying? Because I suspect that your political ideology is unlikely to align with that. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that this is, as you said, like a pithy but ultimately hollow kind of claim. There are certainly medications that are useful to treat symptoms. And additionally, I take some issues with the idea or this like implicit kind of argument against the use of medicines to treat symptoms. Like, I wonder if you've ever seen anybody who is like vomiting their brains out when they get, you know, some of the most intensive like chemotherapy infusions that are sometimes required, or somebody who has like an open fracture and is in extreme pain.
Nope.
Yeah. I suspect that the use of medicines to treat symptoms is quite useful in that situation. And then for a lot of other diseases, there is still a role to manage symptoms to the extent that they impair somebody's quality of life. Like the idea of what we're trying to do is to help people live better, not just, you know, live longer at all costs. There's kind of room for both here, and you would prefer to use the appropriate tool for the appropriate circumstance. So, for example, if somebody is having debilitating symptoms from an acute condition that is likely to get better on its own, like a cold, there's nothing wrong with using some Tylenol to help manage the symptoms so that you can continue to function a little bit better, maybe to take care of your kid or, like, you know, work or do what you need to do in your life while the natural history of the condition takes its course. And then there are other conditions that actually require some more specific targeted treatment to what is driving the issue. So if instead of a common viral cold, you have a pneumococcal pneumonia, then I can give you a simple antibiotic that'll probably get you feeling better relatively quickly. If you'd prefer to not use that because you view that as just treating symptoms, then I hope to not meet you on a ventilator, you know, as can happen to some people who experience pneumonia. So I think that, you know, medicines are just tools and they ought to be used judiciously, at the lowest dose necessary to achieve the intended goal for the shortest period of time necessary to achieve the intended goal. This is a typical conversation I have with folks all the time. And there are some conditions for which a higher dose may be needed, and that's okay. And there are some conditions for which a longer course or an indefinite course may be beneficial or prove to have benefits that outweigh the potential downsides for that person, their goals, their, you know, values, things like that, in which case that's fine too. But transcribing that into a Threads post is less sexy, I think.
Yeah. What do you like? What do you think if you just come, if I just said antibiotics, like what about antibiotics treating an infection? Am I treating the symptom, the root cause, or both? And they're like, well, the environment, you know, seeded this individual. It's like, so we need to like large scale environmental change. Like if so, we agree, but yeah. So then what do you do about the infection? Because you can't, going back to change the environment doesn't help this particular person who's now septic. So like,
yeah, they may well blame the person for like, you know, having such poor health that they were like vulnerable to this
susceptible
infection, because that's their perception, is that like if you get an infection, it's probably your fault. So
if you were a better person, yeah, you wouldn't get an infection. I think that tracks. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Let's move on to the next one. This person said most nutrition issues did not start when manufacturers started putting chemicals into food. They started when you began to eat them. My reply was, everything on this planet, including food, is made of chemicals. If you wanted to make a case for ultra-processed foods with added sugar, added sodium, and or added fat being cheap, desirable, tasty, and ubiquitous in the modern food environment, that would be reasonable, which is just kind of lost in this, again, hollow statement. It's like, oh, chemicals. Chemicals are universally bad. It's like, what do you think the environment that you interact with, your body included, is like made of? It's just non-chemical matter? Like, what the heck?
I think that the phrasing of this, you know, that's one angle to take at this, to which they would respond like, bro, you know what I mean when I'm talking about chemicals. It's the added stuff. And still, even in that context, the counter is that, you know, kind of like there is a way to do food engineering in a health promoting way. That's actually like a whole thing that is actively being done in terms of altering, for example, sodium composition, fiber composition, various other, you know, elements of food. Not to mention, you know, the OG chemicals that were added to food was like vitamin and mineral fortification of things that has markedly reduced the incidence of, you know, scurvy, for example, or, you know, rickets, various other sorts of things. And so,
yeah, or you know, spoilage there are, or like, you know, yeah, like food insecurity, like tainted, you know, foods has gone down markedly because of the addition of chemicals.
Yeah. So I think, as with, you know, I could actually rewind this to my same answer in the previous question. To the extent that medicines are chemicals, which they are, here we also have other forms of chemicals that are tools to us when we are able to add them to things, which can have a health promoting or a, you know, health detracting effect, depending on the specific chemical, the dose, the, you know, not only that is added, but the dose that is ingested, things like that. And so, you know, you and I, for example, are well known from time to time to ingest some ice cream. And that ice cream is not, you know, the whatever paleo, like egg yolks and heavy cream type of ice cream. It is any ice cream that we prefer, much of which might have some kind of an additive to it or some kind of chemical on the back. However, with the dose that we are consuming and in the context of everything else, we do not appear to be suffering ill consequences from it. But all of these things that can be added can have, again, just it can be good or bad, depending on what it is and the dosage and the person that is consuming it. And so I think that, you know, these are obviously more granular takes on these things than a pithy one-liner that goes on Threads, but it's unhelpful to tell people just like no chemicals for sure.
Yeah. So it's like, are you sure? Just Aeritarian? That's what we're doing? Just all O2, but it's not the chemical form. All right. This next one, Alona Maher, she's the rugby player from the United States, said that she has a BMI of 30, which is technically classified as, quote, overweight. And she is in the Olympics. BMI is a poor measure for individuals, but a decent measure for a population. She is jacked and athletic. If you are not jacked and athletic and have a high BMI, there's a very high probability that your health and performance would improve by losing some body fat. I sometimes I feel like I'm like the BMI defender. Like if I was an Avenger character, it'd be BMI. BMI's here. Like, great. He's going to talk to people about the nuances of body mass index. But you know, initially I'm reading this and I'm like, all right, so what is she? Does she actually have a BMI of 30? Now, her reported height and weight, 5'10 and 200 pounds. So her BMI is 28.7, which is in the overweight range. That goes from 25 to 29.9. 30 is the cut point for obesity and is very specific for excess adiposity, excess body fat, even in athletes. It's not very sensitive however, missing about half of people with excess adiposity, excess body fat, but who also have a low BMI. That's the skinny fat sort of phenotype that we talk about sometimes. Most guidelines do recommend adding a waist circumference to help. And I agree that those with excess adiposity, as determined by BMI plus waist circumference, would likely benefit from weight loss. So it wasn't so much saying like, hey, this whole thing's wrong, but like everything but the last sentence was kind of wrong. And also, I don't think we need to demonize BMI any further than it's already, you know, it doesn't need a glow up, right? But we don't need to pile on and just tell people to ignore it, because again, for the vast majority of people, right, individuals included, if your BMI is over 30, probably points to carrying some excess body fat. Yes, there's going to be exceptions to every rule, but I'm fine with that. You know, those people can be outraged because it's just a statistical aberration. Like, I'm never going to hear from these people.
Yeah. I do wonder, I mean, what would be your response, you know, to the idea that BMI is most useful at the extremes, say, you know, below 18 and greater than 35 or something like that. You could argue greater than 30 if that's the cutoff that you want to use, where it's most useful. And then in between that, do you think that, for example, a waist measurement alone would give you all of the information you need in that in-between range? It's just the issue is that BMI is, relatively speaking, easier to measure and more accurate, not accurate, but more reliable to measure, because it doesn't require a particular technique as does measuring somebody's waist circumference, you know, in terms of like, where do you place the tape and how tight and various other things that can lead to a little bit of error. There's just less error in the BMI measurement, so it makes it easier, faster, and kind of more reliable to do, but its accuracy is greatest at the highest range, greater than say 30 or 35, depending on, you know, how high you want to go. And then low end, you know, definitely like say sub 18 or something like that. And in between, if you can get a reliable, accurate waist measurement, then you could do just fine just doing a waist measurement in between and not bothering with the BMI. What is your thought on that?
I'd probably, that's a good point. I'd probably sign on to somewhere like between 20 and 30. I'm like almost not concerned what somebody's BMI is. You know, just because a waist circumference in and of itself or a waist to hip ratio, like you could do whatever you want. There's unfortunately not a ton of evidence on waist to hip ratio. It's more on just waist circumference, and BMI, again, has been studied for a long time. So that's just why it's used in, you know, by convention. The problem is that I don't know how to make an electronic medical record where BMI doesn't auto calculate, right? So like when people are getting a weight and getting a height, the electronic medical record that gets plugged into just spits it out automatically.
Yeah.
And then so people will see then on their chart, because again, this is like the Swiss cheese model of like, you're like, oh, well, if you have an overweight BMI, it's going to be, you're going to get diagnosed with being an individual with overweight. And it's like, well, I don't know that I would put that on everybody's chart that's got a BMI between 25 and 29.9. Rather, at that point, I wish like a red flag would pop up, you know, or even if that's 23 to include individuals of Asian descent, for example, oh, this person needs a waist circumference for sure, right? Whereas a person probably doesn't need a waist circumference above 30 and probably doesn't need one below 20, because you already know what's going on. Obviously, there are exceptions to that. If you're super jacked, with the BMI plus 30, congratulations. I have other questions for you, but
sure.
That's, you know.
How'd you get there?
Yeah, how'd you get there, right? But yeah, I would agree with that. I just think like, how do you stop the BMI from kind of auto-populating once you have somebody's weight and height?
Yeah.
And how would you just predict somebody's BMI to be between 20 and 30 without weighing them? You know, you got a trained eyeball. And then you have to sign on to that, you know, as a medical professional, like, yeah, I eyeballed them up. I think their BMI is probably 27, so I didn't do anything else.
Yeah, I do not trust my eyeball test for that.
Yeah. All right. Next one. This was actually from a physician. So let's see. Starts out, check mark. Magnesium decreases inflammation and relaxes the nervous system. For example, when you exercise, lactate accumulates in your blood, which leads to tired and achy limbs. However, magnesium can prevent this lactate accumulation, which in turn improves energy levels. Just almost like a word salad of nonsense here. So my reply, lactate is not the reason that people experience DOMS. We actually did a whole podcast on this, nor is it a cause of fatigue during exercise or after. Magnesium supplementation also does not affect lactate levels during exercise, nor does it improve performance. People may recommend magnesium supplementation for other reasons, though the evidence isn't particularly great in this space. Lots of papers on mechanisms and potential outcomes, but little positive evidence on important outcomes, which is true. People will rally on about various types of magnesium, various doses of magnesium, and say, oh, look at this. You know, it's a panacea. It does everything. And it's like, great, what's the evidence base for that? And then invariably, it's a mechanism study. And you're like, okay, interesting. But has this been verified with multiple, like, relatively large scale, you know, randomized placebo-controlled trials? If not, I don't know how confidently you can say that other than saying it's an idea right now. It's a hypothesis sort of generating paper, which is fine. I wouldn't push back against that. I would just say that it's unlikely that magnesium is going to be this panacea because, again, I think we'd already have a signal in the data if true, though magnesium supplementation can be useful in various settings, particularly in the obstetric setting, but has nothing to do with lactate during exercise, and lactate is really not the main player here. This is just a misunderstanding of exercise.
This is a misunderstanding of a lot of things, and this I find to be most common, well, I won't say most common, but extremely common when it relates to claims around magnesium, and I think that's because, much like vitamin D, magnesium does have a physiologic role in a ton of different things in the body. It's involved in so many different enzymatic reactions and physiologic processes to some degree, right? And so you can just string together this chain of seeming logic that sounds good to folks if you're like, well, magnesium's involved in, you know, 500 different enzymatic reactions, therefore, you know, you should be taking magnesium. And it's like you kind of skipped a step where you showed me that doing that helps, you know, pretty reliably. And so that's kind of the step that's often missing here. You know, I pay attention to magnesium levels probably more often than anyone else in the inpatient internal medicine setting, where I'm oftentimes doing things with people's kidneys and making them pee a bunch of stuff out and kind of manipulating these levels. But still, it is extremely uncommon for me to see, you know, some kind of complication or like situation that I can directly attribute to like, oh, this is specifically happening because their magnesium levels are too low or too high, both of which are, you know, uncommon at the extremes. So I think magnesium is cool, I guess, but that's about as far as I would go with my claim.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing. You talked about this during our vitamin D podcast, which is, man, a couple years old now, but still, you know, I feel as
evergreen,
good as ever about
as they
that.
Say.
Yeah. You need, if you were trying to show a benefit of supplementing magnesium, right? If the claim is as follows, most people are deficient in magnesium, most people would benefit for X, Y, and Z by supplementing magnesium, then what you need to show is a study where, okay, they measured magnesium levels before in an accurate way, and there's some complexity with measuring magnesium levels, okay? Oh, you were deficient before. We gave you this particular supplement at this particular dose. We measured you sometime later, and you are now at this new level, not deficient, presumably, and also improvement in these outcomes to a reliable level, like it not only just a number change, but like, oh, this actually matters too.
Yeah.
And that type of data is few and far between when it comes to mag, which is why I'm kind of, when people ask, hey, should I supplement with this specific type of magnesium? I'm like, I'm not convinced. And it doesn't mean I'll never be convinced, but right now I just think we're lacking some evidence there.
Yeah. The main situations where I find myself using it is, you know, people with severe deficiencies in the context of significant alcohol use issues, such that they're generally malnourished, like they're low in everything, not just magnesium. And then, you know, certain other, you know, kidney disorders that can lead to this issue, which again, are also uncommon. So not a super frequent thing that I end up recommending that people take, and many different formulations are relatively poorly absorbed. And this, I suppose, can be useful for constipation in that they can cause diarrhea. So
yeah, hey, there you go. Not to be confused with hyperdefecation, which is its own.
Yes, true.
Yeah. All right, next one. Grip strength is one of the vital signs we can measure to predict how well someone will age. Grip strength is associated with 1, longevity and lower risk of death from all the things. 2, better bone mineral density. 3, healthier heart. 4, reduced risk of certain cancers. 5, better neurological health. In fact, low grip strength is associated with increased cognitive decline and increased risk of developing dementia. How can you improve grip strength? More gibberish after that about specific grip strengthening exercises. I do appreciate the sort of nuance here in the list, like some types of cancer. Usually that's missed on threads like this, on threads or otherwise. So my response was actually, which I feel like an idiot now saying, actually, strength from regular weight training doesn't seem to correlate well with grip strength. Rather, a decline in grip strength represents significant strength loss from reduced muscle function that is associated with disease. Grip strength is not a great predictor of muscle function or health unless it is very low, though at that level, the test doesn't really add much diagnostically. We agree that improving strength and strength training are both beneficial, but focusing on grip strength directly is not. And so what I meant by that specifically about grip strength not being a great predictor of muscle function or health, unless it's very low, is that once your grip strength has actually gone down to a level where we're like, oh shit, it's low. Well, yeah, we know that you have muscle wasting and poor muscle performance, but I didn't need a test to tell me that, or a grip strength, which is like a specialized piece of equipment to measure that. I could have had you try to stand up out of a chair, for example, five times, and I would have been able to diagnose that. So what I'm getting at is that small changes in grip strength, higher or lower, not only don't reliably occur from actually resistance training, which we all agree is important, but they also don't predict your trajectory, because it's just not as sensitive of a test as we'd like it to be in actually kind of correlating with those types of outcomes. It's just, you know, even people who are like high level, national level Olympic weightlifters have about the same grip strength as their untrained controls. They just have less of a discrepancy between their dominant and non-dominant hands in grip strength performance. And you're like, well, if these people are national level weightlifters, right? So they're very strong compared to their untrained peers or insufficiently active sort of age-matched peers. You'd expect some signal showing, dang, their grip strength is way higher, but it's not. Because again, this is not a super sensitive test for like muscle performance, muscle strength, unless it is at the extremes. In this case, the extreme being very, very low.
Yeah, that's one kind of counter to this. I think the other and more egregious one that I would take, because if somebody wants to monitor people's grip strength, for example, the worst thing here is like the conclusion. So how do you improve grip strength? Suggesting that directly targeting the strength of the intrinsic muscles of your hand is going backwards through these going to improve your neurological health, improve your reduce your risk of cancer, improve your cardiovascular health just by like squeezing something with your hand, for example. And that's just, again, a leap that does not work here. I mean, I could reword this whole thing and say, like, when your car's check engine light turns on, it is associated with an increased risk of car crashes, an increased risk of your car breaking down, an increased risk of you becoming frustrated with your vehicle, an increased amount of vehicle-related expenses. So how can we turn off your car's check engine light? That's kind of the level of reasoning here. It is something that is, sure, associated with all of these things, because all of these things, including grip strength and cardiovascular health and neurological health and cancer, share some degree of underlying mechanism, common mechanism that can contribute to all of them rather than the grip strength causing all of those things. So saying that they're associated, so I should train my grip, is not the move here. Rather to say, yeah, if it's low and I, to the extent that I'm concerned about like overall low strength, I should be training in general overall everywhere, not just my hands, and fooling myself into thinking there's something magic about grip.
Yeah. If the thread was, having decreased muscular performance is associated with bad health trajectory, make sure that you're strength training to, you know, contribute to your physical 401k. I'd be like, awesome.
Yeah. But then nobody else is really engaging with that on threads. So
yeah. Yeah. I don't know. And then further, okay, here's a clinical question, Austin. So let's say that you had a hand grip dynamometer and you were all tuned up on like all the norms of this particular type of hand grip dynamometer, because they're different from like device to device. And even if something as simple as like the grip texture, like, is it smooth versus textured or ribbed, I suppose? Anyway, if you had a patient who was insufficiently active when they came to see you and you're like, I think you should lift weights, you should do this type of program, whatever exercise that you like, train all the major muscles groups of the body, between a rep range of 3 to 20 reps, it should be pretty hard at the end of each set. Do it a couple times a week. Come back. We'll, you know, see how you're doing. They do that religiously for 6 months. They come back and their grip strength hasn't improved. Is that worrisome to you?
To some extent, I suppose, although I would still not rely on that one piece of data to make a determination about, you know, their general health and physiologic response to the training.
My leg press doubled, my chest press doubled, my, you know, my 10-minute walk test, I was able to double the distance, you know, but my grip strength, what's going on with my grip strength? Do I need the squeezers, doc? Come on.
Yeah, no, with all that additional information, I feel great about their training response and therefore the health effects of their training. And so I'm unconcerned with the grip issue and would tell them only train your grip if you have a specific reason to care about your grip, but not your health.
There you go. All right. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer is here, and that means a lot of you are going to want to spend more time outside and less time on meal prep, all while staying on track with your nutrition. For many, a meal prep service like Factor can bridge that gap. Now, I've been using Factor for a while now, just here and there when I'm spending more time away from home or don't have time to cook, and it's made my day delicious and easy. Meals are ready in just 2 minutes, and they have everything from breakfast to dinner and even dessert, so you can stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. They also have 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons. I am a creature of habit, but there's a lot of different stuff to choose from, so you'll always have new flavors to explore. So head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. I wanted to take a second and talk about our new podcast sponsor, Mint Mobile. With big wireless providers, what you see is never what you get. Somewhere between the store and your first month's bill, the price you thought you were paying magically skyrockets. With Mint Mobile, you'll never have to worry about gotchas ever again, because when they say $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan, they mean it. There's no surprise monthly bills and unexpected overages. They have premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month, and all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/BBM. That's mintmobile.com/BBM. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/BBM. $45 upfront payment required, that's equivalent to $15 a month, and this is limited to new customers on a first 3 month plan only. Speeds are slower above 40 gigabytes on the unlimited plan, and additional taxes, fees, and restrictions may apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Next one, contrary to popular belief, having low cholesterol can have very dangerous side effects. And then there's like a hazard emoji. That was the extent of the thread. And my response was, this is not true, though many diseases can cause but are not caused by low cholesterol levels. Save for that, the lower the better, and that is supported by overwhelming amounts of evidence. Thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is something we've discussed before, where many different things that we can measure in the blood go down when people are ill. This includes, in some situations, things like blood cholesterol. This also includes vitamin D, hence why there's so much associative data between low vitamin D levels and all sorts of diseases, because a lot of diseases can make it go down. This includes, in light of our recent episodes on the thyroid, things like TSH. This includes things like testosterone, which also contributes to the reams of associative data between low testosterone and various medical conditions. And so this is just the same kind of paradigm of people seeing these kind of associative data, if they're even looking at any of the data, and drawing a direct causal kind of relationship. And if there is one, it might be pointing in the direction opposite these people think, or perhaps the direction opposite that they want it to be. And so that's what leads to these kind of claims. So, you know, there are certainly some genetic conditions, I will say. There are rare dyslipidemias that can lead to abnormally low, quote unquote, levels of blood cholesterol with other complications. But that is usually due to actual impairments in your cholesterol metabolism. But those are very uncommon. And arguably, I shouldn't have even said any of that. if there's going to be somebody who's going to well actually me on that and point out some scenario where there's some rare genetic mutation that leads to rapidly accelerating atherosclerotic disease or fatty liver disease or something like that, but those are again uncommon. So most of the time, if I say I have a patient that I'm seeing, and I say I check a lipid panel and it is like extremely low blood lipid levels, extremely low LDL levels, total cholesterol levels, things like that, and they are not on lipid lowering therapy. And let's say that otherwise they are not, from what I can tell, like the picture of health, pursuing every route they have available to them to, do this through dietary and lifestyle means, I actually have concerns that they have some kind of underlying, disease state that is yet to be identified. And I might be on the hunt, for example, for cancer or some chronic infection or something like that. Right. So that's not unusual in the same way that, I think I've told you a couple times before, like the absolute lowest blood testosterone level that I've ever seen was in a patient who had AIDS. And, you know, that was a situation where they had this severe chronic inflammatory, you know, disease. And, you know, that was the main thing that probably needed to be treated in the short term. And I suspect that, you know, whether or not they returned all the way to fully normal eugonadal function, you know, you'd have to see how that goes. But assuming that one is directly causal of the other, for example, especially in that situation where it's just a straight infectious thing, would be silly.
Yeah. All right. Next one. Our nutritional guidelines are a lie. For years, we've been pushed towards low-fat, high-carb diets and processed foods. These so-called, quote, guidelines have flooded our supermarkets with ready-to-eat frozen meals where the protein is smothered in breading, box cereals loaded with sugar, and added ingredients you can't even find in a store. Standard dietary guidelines are directly and indirectly responsible for the explosion of chronic illness, autoimmune illnesses, as well as the rise in cancer and heart disease. A ketogenic lifestyle, as well as a carnivore lifestyle, have proven to be healing for millions of people. Processed foods have no place in a healthy society. A ketogenic approach is considered to be 50 carbs or lower. In a well-balanced diet, there's no need to consume more than 50 carbs a day. Hashtag keto lifestyle. Bro, there's so many claims. I'll read you my reply. What part or parts of the 2020 to 2025 dietary guidelines do you specifically disagree with? Considering that less than 5% of the population gets anywhere near these guidelines, which would be health promoting if people actually ate them, I suspect it will be difficult to blame these guidelines for the conditions that you list. To be clear, the dietary guidelines do not recommend ultra-processed foods, though virtually all foods are at least minimally processed, and there's no definition for, quote, processed food anyway. Yes, the modern food environment is extremely problematic, but a ketogenic diet is not going to fix this, nor is it necessarily health promoting for many people based on existing data.
If you just listen to that whole thing that you read out from them, they are clearly just a hardcore evangelist for this. You know what I mean? It might be something that they adopted relatively recently, and maybe they found a support group effectively, like a social status among that group. They are seeing nonstop floods of like positive, you know, reinforcement, both personally, and maybe they're hearing, you know, people's success stories and stuff. And, you know, I'm not going to detract from people's success stories. You know, those are often provide an incomplete picture of the overall effects of these types of interventions. And so it's not often super productive to, you know, engage with hardcore evangelists, especially when they're brand new and fresh with their new hashtag keto lifestyle that they added on to the end there, right? Respect for trying, I suppose.
This particular individual had a MHPC in their bio, like after their name, which I thought to meant Masters in Public Health candidate, and so I was like, well, clearly you're somewhere, you know, in the academic system. You're learning to be a steward of public health information. So we gotta engage a little bit here. You know, I want to see you do great things in the future. Then I realized that was actually an acronym for like a carnivore type lifestyle certification.
Yeah, you're not getting anywhere with them, dude.
Nope, but I learned that after the fact. That was post hoc analysis. I messed that up. But that's the case though. Like if people are going to blame the dietary guidelines on particular illnesses, conditions, you know, how people eat, right off the bat, you should say, well, how many people do you think are actually eating the guidelines? And do you know what the current guidelines are? Because I do think that if most people read or at least looked at the materials from the 2020 to 2025 dietary guidelines, they'd be like, oh yeah, you recommend like lean protein, eating like a minimally processed diet to the bet your best abilities, eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, you know, fiber containing foods, avoiding foods with added sugars, avoiding ultra processed foods, like pretty reasonable stuff, right? And then you have to ask, well, how many people do you think are actually eating that? And they go, oh, everyone obviously is eating that. It's like, if nobody's eating those guidelines, which is in fact has been studied and been shown to be true, almost nobody's eating those guidelines, then how do you blame all of these outcomes on the guidelines? The only way that you can do that, I think, is to say these guidelines are so mismatched to the current food environment that they are unattainable.
Sure.
And so therefore unactionable and therefore useless.
Yeah. You know, an interesting observation here that I just kind of thought of. nobody ever attacks the physical activity guidelines.
Yeah.
You could generate a similar type of argument. You could say, for years we've been pushed towards, you know, high volumes of, you know, 150 to 300 minutes a week of moderate intensity aerobic activity. These so-called guidelines blah, 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 go through the same thing. And if you presented something like that to them, they're like, how do you feel about the physical activity guidelines? And they'd be like, they're fine.
Yeah. Nobody does them, but yeah, you know, right. Otherwise fine.
Interesting, huh? Maybe try that the next time.
I will. That might be my Threads post for tonight. All right. All right, let's move on to the next one. Ever heard of NEAT? NEAT is capitalized like an acronym here. It stands for non-exercise activity thermogenesis. Individuals with a higher needs score have better insulin sensitivity. To increase your NEAT, simply move more and sit less. Example, take the stairs and not the elevator. Take a break from sitting for extended periods of time. My response was, what you describe is exercise, which is called EAT, exercise-associated thermogenesis, exercise activity thermogenesis. NEAT is not generally under conscious control, though can relate to lifestyle in the case of occupational activity. Telling people to move more and sit less is also not particularly helpful for behavior change. Thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is something that really nobody, unless they've deliberately nerded out on this topic, has ever actually really thought about. The idea of how much involuntary movement you do throughout the day, just like fidgeting, you know, bouncing your leg, moving around in various ways, all of that, that again, you don't actively think about when you're doing it. It just kind of happens. And so different people have just different baseline levels of this stuff happening. And then also it seems that this stuff also spontaneously and not consciously changes. For example, when you go into a significant calorie deficit or other types of situations, the point of it is that you don't choose how much NEAT you do. You can choose how much EAT you do, both in the term of exercise activity thermogenesis and also, you know, eating to some extent, but still even part of that is outside of your conscious control. So this stuff is just a lot more complicated. And unless you've deliberately been taught this or gone out of your way to learn it, it's not something that is intuitive to anybody or that they would realize on their own.
Yeah, I think what happens is people are like, huh, why don't when people like try to engage in weight loss, a weight loss intervention, so, you know, calorie restriction plus adding exercise, how come on average they don't lose as much weight as what we predict, or how come it's difficult for them to, sustain it long term? And kudos to these folks, because you end up in some sort of, you know, academic related source that tells you about NEAT, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, and that is a variable that changes in response to weight loss attempts in folks who are relatively unlucky from a genetic standpoint. NEAT can decrease by a lot, meaning that you're burning less calories from, again, mostly unconscious activities. And so if you see this and you're like, well, if I just told people to increase their NEAT, you know, that's the biohack that everyone needs. That's how they would be able to achieve and sustain this this weight loss. But unfortunately, what you're telling people to do is just exercise more, which is maybe a fine recommendation if, sure, you know, getting people to exercise more. But I don't think that's particularly sexy.
Yeah,
like if the thing just said exercise more,
people would be like, okay,
okay, yeah. Although the last thing I'll say on this is, I think there's a limitation, you know, as far as like how much does extra exercise actually help with weight maintenance, especially for people again with certain genetic sort of makeups. You can't really out exercise your way, you know, to this. You'll just decrease energy expenditure from other types of processes to some extent, not 100%, you know, so extra exercise for up to a certain point is probably beneficial. But I think once you're sort of maxing out the current guidelines, and certainly if you're above the current exercise guidelines for physical activity, I don't know that adding more exercise is going to help you sustain weight loss for a long period of time. People will bring up the bodybuilders and they're like, well, look, when bodybuilders, you know, plateau with weight loss and they're getting ready for a show, they just add in more cardio and they restrict calories more. Well, how come it works for them? And I'm like, you're talking about a relatively short-term situation. You know, bodybuilding prep, even at its longest, you know, 5 months, 6 months, we're talking about what happens over years, right? And so the idea that you would use the same approach as a bodybuilder, you know, to get shredded for 6 months for a day, for like lifetime maintenance of, you know, a health promoting body composition and body weight. We're really talking about different things, although the same underlying sort of, you know, math is still there. It's just over a longer time period.
I suspect that much like every other outcome from exercise, there's a ton of individual variation here too, in terms of that, the degree of that compensatory response, I'm sure varies between people.
A lot.
The impact of exercise on subsequent appetite levels, there's probably like completely divergent responses. Some people get hungrier, some people get less hungry. So there's just such enormous variation that any kind of blanket guideline or claim like this is, I think, typically unhelpful.
Yeah, I would say, hey, meet the physical activity guidelines, eat a health-promoting dietary pattern as best to your to the best of your ability. And then if you need additional assistance at achieving a health-promoting body composition and or body weight, you're likely going to need a higher level of intervention, whether that's, you know, behavior change counseling, that plus the medications, that plus or minus surgery, you know, all things are on the table. Okay, last few questions here. Any healthcare professionals out there who can explain the difference between exercise and training? Austin, you can already tell that I just, you know, it spun me up. I said, sure, it's made up. Exercise is a subset of physical activity that is planned, repetitive, and structured to improve or maintain health or fitness. Exercise and, quote, training are sometimes said to be separate pursuits, with training being the process of preparing an athlete for performance and exercise being a structured physical activity. Stone, that's a person, and a few others started using this term over a decade ago to specifically refer to athlete preparation. Seems arbitrary, shoulder shrug. It's not a huge deal, but I think if you try to differentiate exercise from physical activity and then differentiate training from exercise, the definition no longer works. To me, defining exercise is far more important for both health and performance than stroking someone's ego about their, quote, training. I call it exercise training whenever possible to ruffle feathers. And what I meant by all of that was defining what is like the lower limit for what counts as exercise to me is a more interesting question and more important. Like, oh, what counts towards the physical activity guidelines, for example, or what counts as cardiovascular exercise versus just like, you know, household activity or occupational activity. And we see some divergence in, you know, health outcomes related to occupational activity compared to leisure time activity. So defining what is exercise to me is far more important than drawing this line in the sand between exercise and training. But I understand that some people want to call their own exercise training. I just don't know why.
Yeah, I am not sure that it is possible for me to care less about about something. To the extent that, yeah, I don't know, if it helps somebody's mental framing of their own physical pursuits, and if that's all it takes for you to like be more consistent with your exercise is to view it through that lens, like, or for it to be more goal directed, cool, good, you know, that's good for you. I don't think that that needs to be the case for everybody, for sure.
Yeah, I just think, you know, allow me to maybe pontificate on this, right? So if you're the type of person where calling it training makes you potentially more adherent, at least in this short term of initiating exercise, I'm behind that 100%. I do have a concern though that type of mindset and like attributing this importance or potentially like superiority to your specific type of training could potentially be problematic, especially if you view training as like, well, since I'm preparing for, you know, the unknown and unknowable, or I'm preparing for life, or I'm preparing for this recreational sport, that every training session's performance matters, like how much you lift, for example, like to a very, you know, the nth degree, and like you got to push it every single time to make progress. I have concerns about that type of individual. And so I would actually maybe move somebody away from this arbitrary distinction between exercise and training if they kind of checked all those boxes. If they're like, I'm going to war, it's training time. And it's like, honestly, man, it just needs to be heavy enough to work, and it's probably not as hard as you think it needs to be. And in fact, I'd suggest it probably would work better if you got a little bit further away from failure. Whereas there are certainly some people who are, you know, underdosed and undertrained. In fact, that's probably most of the population because they don't exercise at all. But the people that are listening to this podcast in general and that are like arguing over training versus exercise, I have little concern that they're like not loading the bar heavy enough. In fact, I'm more so worried that they're loading it too heavy and not training enough total to get all the benefits out of exercise. Or if they want to call it training, fine. What do you think about that?
That's possible, I suppose. You know, I think that, you know, as with many other things we discuss, there's different approaches, whether when it comes to prescription or like mental framing, that might work better or differently for a different person to get them started, to get them consistent, and to get them towards whatever particular goal they may have in mind. And so I think that getting a better appreciation of that degree of inter-individual variation has probably been one of the, I would say there's been like a couple really, really important things on which, you know, over the past however many years we've been doing this, decade plus, that we've like kind of evolved to recognize a lot more the significance of. And that's one of them, rather than, you know, trying to pigeonhole everybody into the same kind of phenotypic situation and expect the same training response out of them in response to the same training intervention. I don't know that we ever really went quite that far with it, but that's certainly like a take that exists.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. Just 10 out of 10 would recommend calling it exercise training. Really piss people off. I'm in support of that. All right. My doctor told me 10,000 steps really isn't enough for fat loss or to be considered active anymore. She told me new studies found 10,000 steps is maintenance mode for folks who have achieved their weight loss, and people who hadn't only differed 1 or 2 pounds while walking 10,000 steps per day. She said 15,000 is really the baseline for fat loss. And honestly, that's where I began to see the biggest transformation and improvement. Doing 20,000 steps has been a beast. After this, my sweet spot will be aiming for 17,000 steps per day. My response: your doctor made all that up. There is no step count for weight loss, though 10,000 steps per day done at a brisk pace would almost certainly meet the conditioning level recommended in the current guidelines. Existing guidelines also recommend twice per week resistance training. That said, energy balance is overwhelmingly created via the diet, not physical activity past a certain point, especially for long-term results. Would not recommend 15 or 20,000 steps per day for weight loss, generally speaking. Thoughts?
I'm curious about your last sentence there when you say would not recommend. I think that what you mean to say is that that's not going to be like your go-to first line standard recommendation for all comers who are trying to manage their weight, not that you would recommend against it in somebody who is already doing it or wants to do it.
Is that not encapsulated by the phrase generally speaking?
Yeah, I think that people will interpret that in various ways and say, well, this doctor said he wouldn't recommend people take 15 or 20,000 steps a day. And it's like, well, you can.
If you want to, that's fine. Yeah.
But I just think, go ahead.
1,000 steps is about 10 minutes for people to walk, okay? And the average person in the United States, this does vary, again, between individuals based on occupation, disease states, mobility, et cetera. Mobility, I don't mean like how much they foam roll or how much they stretch. I mean how often they can get up and get around the house or at their workplace, is about 5,000 to 6,000 steps per day. So if the average, will be generous and say it's 6,000 steps per day that people are walking, you know, without any sort of formal exercise, walking another 4,000 steps per day is 40 minutes of activity. Walking 20,000 steps, guys, that's your hours, okay, every day. And while I'm not opposed to that much exercise, particularly if somebody wants to do it, I do start to wonder, like, don't you have other things to do? And mightn't this time be better spent doing other things? And so the only way that I would recommend somebody, like, yeah, do 15,000 steps a day, aim for that, 20,000 steps per day, would be like, I love to walk.
Yeah.
I live to walk. Let me walk, doc. And I'd be like, hey, man, go off, but also make sure you lift some weights. If somebody was like, how much activity do I need to lose weight? I would try to get them to the physical activity guidelines first. Probably walking wouldn't be like my main go-to unless that was the only thing accessible to them, in which case I have other concerns associated with that type of situation. But yeah, the idea that, hey, the reason why you're not losing weight is because you're not walking enough after you're already doing 10,000 steps a day, I'm more concerned with the dietary pattern at that point, plus or minus additional like resistance training overall, rather than, hey, you should just double that. I don't know.
Yeah, there's kind of a pragmatic angle that you're taking at this in terms of what's feasible for most people, what's, you know, worth spending that amount of time on, and is that going to be to the detriment of them of being able to, you know, resistance train adequately or just like live their life? Or is this a blanket recommendation everybody should be walking for hours every single day and potentially detracting from other areas of their life to get there, which makes it a questionable recommendation to apply in general.
Plus the idea that you need 20,000 steps per day or that amount of conditioning total. So again, 20,000 steps per day, that's, you know, an extra 140 minutes of cardio, you know, conditioning activity every day. That's what you need to lose weight. I disagree. I think when you actually look at evidence on this where people engage in massive amounts of endurance activity, you know, type exercise, in general, the weight loss results are modest at best. And if you look out long enough, almost, you know, little to no weight loss actually occurs reliably. There's a huge inter-individual variation there. So if someone's doing this just to lose weight, I think that effort can be better spent doing other stuff.
There you go. I'm on board with that take.
Or I would just say, generally speaking.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, last one here. More reps cause more fatigue. You're better off doing 5 reps than 15 reps. My reply, this is not necessarily true, though you'd have to define fatigue and how it's being measured, along with other variables such as proximity to failure. Would not make the blanket statement that, quote, you're better off doing 5 reps than 15 for hypertrophy or specific types of strength. I understand the line of thinking, as it is likely to be true for hypertrophy on a set single set basis. However, it's quite reductionist overall with respect to the program in its entirety. For example, this is a particularly odd statement when it comes to fatigue management and program design. Also, no, training 5s and 15s will not generate the same strength adaptations. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, my immediate first thought on this was just the proximity to failure question being a really important one to recognize. And when you're comparing fatigue between these two things, an absolute all-out set of 5 to 2 or past the point of failure compared with a set of 15 that is submaximal in nature is definitely going to have differing levels of fatigue pretty significantly. I mean, I've been exceptionally fatigued, sore, and had marked reductions in performance for relatively long periods of time, days, sometimes on the order of a couple of weeks, from taking very, very low rep sets to failure, or like after my all-time heaviest, I've told you this before, after my all-time heaviest sumo deadlift, my next week's deadlift attempt, you know, top single or something at the time, was like 160 pounds lighter or something like that, and performance stayed down for like a couple of weeks, and that was after a single. You know, you could say like you're better off doing 1 than, you know, 10 or something, but it's like, well, I suffered pretty debilitating fatigue and reduction in performance from that, just because of the proximity to failure that I dealt with on that set. So I'm with you on that. Yeah. One.
Well, maybe a more interesting question. You got a set of 5 reps at RP8, so two reps left in the tank, versus a set of 15 to RP8, 2 reps left in the tank. This claim is that, hey, look, given the same proximity to failure, 5 reps is less fatiguing than doing more reps. Why? Because you're doing more reps. And that is, again, another reductionist take, but it requires you to define what fatigue is, which people who actually are in this space, when you start discussing about definitions of fatigue, people, they start stammering and start waving their hands around, just like I'm doing right now, really quickly, because defining fatigue is very difficult. The definition that we use is, you know, the physiological and psychological, negative physiological and negative psychological effects of physical activity. That's our lump sort of definition of fatigue, admittedly not that specific and vague intentionally. What most people are talking about is like fatigability, relating to like muscle force production, but fatigue is not just a reduction in muscular force production. That's strength performance. That's what you're talking about, which is really a balance between fatigue that's on board and fitness adaptations that are on board. So it gets far more complex. Now, when people say, oh, a set of 5 at 8 is less fatiguing than a set of 15 at 8, I was like, you're just talking about peripheral fatigue. You know, if you wanted to differentiate between the different types of fatigue, peripheral fatigue being related to like muscle damage or accumulation or depletion of, you know, certain metabolic byproducts and energy sources. Whereas 5 at 8 is more centrally fatiguing. If you wanted to go back to like central nervous system outflow. And so if you were trying to make like a fatigue chart, it would be, you know, heavily biased towards central fatigue on the lower rep, heavier stuff, and more peripherally biased towards higher rep efforts, but it's still fatigue. And they have different time courses, and there's a lot of inter-individual variation in how well you're suited for that particular task. The whole point, though, if you took this to its logical end, for hypertrophy, this man is recommending doing sets of 5 on everything for all exercises. Biceps curls, 5s. Leg extensions, 5s. Dumbbell lateral raises, 5s. Upright rows, 5s. Squats, 5s. And it's like,
I think I know this guy.
Yeah, right. I mean, and I was just like, when you come up with a program, it is like an art in fatigue management. The total amount of training stress that the individual that you're programming for experiences is unique to their current fitness levels and needs to be dosed appropriately. And so this is like, it's an art coming up with something that you think is going to match their current level of fitness and their goals all at the same time. And so the idea that you would just send it's all 5s all the time, I'm like, that seems stupid. Also, don't you want to get better at like different tasks relating to muscular function? This is just a permutation of that effective reps sort of model.
Yeah.
And it's like, you took it too far, guys. You took it too far.
Yeah, yeah. There's no reason why you have to do only one or the other. This applies to a lot of things.
No, you just got to do heavy triples. That's it. only heavy sets of three because they're hard. And, you know, that's why you gotta do it. Just like only do sprints to prepare for a marathon.
Said literally no successful marathoner on earth.
Yeah, weird take, weird take. All right, I think that's a wrap here on episode 306. You got any other Quack Watch stuff you want to bring up, or you think that's it?
That's good for today, I think. There'll be no shortage of material for us, I'm sure.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so that is a wrap on episode 306 of the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Special thanks to Dr. Austin Baraki for joining me on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. But before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.